day and welcome to another episode of Subscription Radio. I am your host, DJ Fish, and with me in today's episode, I have my friend Matthew Barnes, founder of Proteus. Matt and I were just trading notes around how to best describe Proteus, and in the back of my head, I was like, it's a cross between NASA and a SWAT team that works with direct-to-consumer brands, where you basically come in with brands that are doing at least $10 million a year in revenue and kind of go end-to-end, help them with growth experiments, everything from the initial hypothesis through implementation. NASA slash plus a SWAT team is what kind of spoke to me while you're talking. Does that feel apt to you? Or
incredible. I'm just going to just ask him what we do, because anybody who's in NASA. No, I mean, that's really it, right? We are one of the nerdiest assassins on the planet. So
I love that.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Anything you want to add into specifically in addition to my preamble?
Yeah. No, we were talking about it, and sometimes I say it's easier to talk about what we're not, but we do. So like, we're not developers, but we do a ton of development. You know, we're not analytics specialists, but we've built our own reporting platform. We're not conversion optimization software, but we have built our own system for deploying tests, right? So it is. It's just really the whole thing is end to end. Our goal is to not add any work. It's a way for us to bolt on to our clients and consult with them and help them figure out what the next level of scale looks like and how to get there.
I was going to say, I hope for anyone who's listening to your description can understand where I was coming from with the whole NASA meets SWAT team connection. But I will say, for context, Matt and I have known each other for at least a couple of years now. First met by, like, we both happened to be working with a brand from like different sides of, we'll say like the consulting vendor relationship. And Matthew's one of those folks who have come to learn an enormous amount just in terms of growth and subscriptions. He teaches me a lot. And so it's been fun. You've been on the podcast at least once before. And excited to have you back. Before we started recording, we started talking about some of the topics that are, I'd say near and dear to your heart, but really sounds like stuff that's been pissing you off.
Enormous sense of frustration. in general.
And I think, and it's 'tis the season, right? With Cyber Monday, Black Friday coming up. And I was going to say, part of what you were even talking about resonates with, I was sort of sympathizing with there are certain situations and certain themes where you often find, this isn't true just for brands, but there's a bit of I referred to it as snow blindness. But really what I'm referring to is sort of like brands have this, and again, it could be any business, it doesn't have to be a brand, but since we're talking about brands, we work with brands, there's this propensity to have a specific KPI or objective that, and in this case, it's subscribers and subscriptions, where a maniacal focus on that at the expense of, maybe even like the business itself. But Matt, I thought you were doing a really good job describing even like what you were seeing and sort of your own, certainly from like an analytics and data perspective, irony of it. Irony is the wrong word.
It's interesting, right? Because we say we want subscription. What we really mean is we want more marginal dollars in the bank account, and subscription becomes a proxy for lifetime value, which is a proxy for lifetime margin. And the biggest thing, the thing I think is quite interesting is when you have a business with a subscription component, to get to a certain level of scale, focusing primarily on subscription is not a terrible strategy, right? Oftentimes it's the best lever that you have to sort of pull. But when you kind of do the financial modeling, like around a business, right? Where you're, so I have like a mechanical engineering background. So I think a lot in terms of like systems, and like one of the examples we use in classes for that is a bathtub, right? So your newest subscribers are the faucet that you're trying to open up and get as much water to come through, right? And your churn is the drain. And that drain is going to drain out a certain percentage of the bathtub every second. And your job is to put as much water in through the top as you can. But you're going to hit a point where you can no longer grow the amount of water in the bathtub or the number of subscribers you have, because you are going to be churning that same percentage for all of time, right? eventually, if you shut the spigot off, the bathtub will empty. You will eventually attrit everyone. But you can get yourself into this real pickle where you've built a ceiling into the business that you're not aware of, because it's impossible for it to grow, because you are always going to be losing more subscribers than you can acquire. And if the ecosystem gets unfavorable for things like CAC, et cetera, and you need to change strategy or whatever, that drain becomes like a real problem. And so thinking about the overall health and like life cycle of like a subscription customer and like ways to mitigate churn and things like that are really, really important. And in many cases for that next level of scale, they're the thing that you need to unlock to be able to even have even the potential to grow, maybe to double the business or whatever you want to do. Otherwise, it's mathematically impossible. There's no CAC on the planet that's going to solve this problem for you.
Great. I love the analogy. I was following along, and I guess I've heard variations of the bathtub one. I think the other piece too would be the at a certain point you're gonna get to the edge of the bathtub, and it's gonna start. You're gonna need a bigger bathtub.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. Well, then we start getting into philosophy of software development, and then I'll totally lose everyone. Yeah.
But I think that, yeah, like the last thing you were saying was essentially we'll get to a point of scale where, let's say, you're churning, I'm just going to use a random word, 10,000 customers today, but you're also acquiring 10,000, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly. The two things are going to equal each other out. So your only option is to increase CAC if you can't reduce churn. And there's obviously a ceiling for profitability on that.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess I'm curious, going back to like in the context you're sort of expressing frustration, what are the typical conversations that you're having? And in your experience, what's the obstacle getting in the way? And are there ways that you encourage brands to kind of look at or think about their business where it's not I think trying to convince someone of something that they don't believe obviously is not helpful. And so I'm curious, how do you sort of walk people through even just like an analysis of their own business thinking about that?
Well, so there's a couple of different facets to it, right? So I always really like diving into like, why are we obsessed with this KPI? Like who's championing this? Where's it coming from? Sometimes the answer is, hey, we have VC money and these guys are kind of old and they think that subscription is the way that we make the money. And I got to put this damn thing in my quarterly report, then say that we grew subscription. They're not going to look at anything else. And the actual overall health of the business isn't the thing we're optimizing for. It's raising more money or something like that, right? Which, here's the thing, that is actually like a totally valid thing to optimize for. So like one of the little asterisks that I put sometimes the goal is to do less in revenue and do more in margin so we don't have to raise a round, or it is to increase a metric that we know is near and dear to the heart of the person who is loaning us the money or something like that. So all fine thing. You just have to know what the North Star is. But in general, right, oftentimes it is a thing where we sort of have this outdated thing, which really a lot of it started at the beginning of like COVID, where everybody's like subscriptions, the whole shebang, right? Like this is the way, you know, we look at lifetime value. It's so much better than like these one-time customers. And like, really, you actually can have like three buckets of customers, right? You have subscription customers who have just told you out of hand, right? Like they're pre-qualified as well engaged because they committed. And then among your pool of one-time customers or individual purchasing customers, you have people who are just new here, right? And have only placed one order, or people who are deadbeats and only placed one order. And then you have a really great cohort of people who have a very high LTV and are just as engaged as a subscriber, but don't purchase through that modality. This is where I see people kind of screw it up, right? So I always say you have multiple businesses within your business. You may have a great subscriber business. You may have a great individual purchasing business with one of the great lifetime value, right? And then you may have this other part of the business, which is the part where you kind of, again, you have like the deadbeats and stuff. And so with some of the customers, I can break down and see that, and it becomes like apparent. There's some intro offer or whatever, but there's a lot of blending that sort of happens, especially on the non-subscriber side of things, that I think really hamstrings people from like their highest growth potential, because especially now on the other side of COVID, there's a non-trivial audience that will just never subscribe. They're just not going to purchase through that modality, and figuring out how to serve them is hard, but that's the work of growing the business. You can't simply just lean on subscribers and be like, and job's done.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because as you were speaking, I think I'm curious in your, like, is there a certain, you talked about like different growth strategies, right? And like in certain circumstances, if your goal is to raise another round, you know, the metric that the investor or the VC is looking at is subscriber growth, then sure. that is a valid strategy. I would have to imagine, and I know that from at least VCs that I've spoken with in the last 12 months, the focus is really much more on payback compression and profitability, or proximity to profitability. So I am curious if that, to what extent that's impacted or influencing the psychology of people they're working with. Maybe there haven't been, your sample size hasn't been, we'll call it wide enough to it really to come up necessarily, or for them to have reoriented their mindsets. But I am curious to what extent people will be susceptible or open to it. Is there a way that you walk people through even an analysis of their customer base to identify those different segments and to sort of like qualify the value of them?
Yeah, totally. So there's a couple of different ways to slice it. It depends on the business. So to answer your first question, some people are like really actually like kind of focused on that. More I see it as like, it's harder to acquire money because interest rates are a thing. And so people are like actually treating the business not like a vehicle to raise money, which is, you know, in my opinion, more fun and honest to do. One of the things that we're testing the hell out of and has seen a tremendous amount of success is I always talk about aligning incentives, right? Where we want to reward good customer behavior, right? And I say that as generally as possible on purpose, because again, you can get so myopic on like one thing, but I'll say like, okay, an intro offer of 15% off your first order is like the stupidest thing you could possibly do for profitability, right? Because you're just taking, in some cases, 30% of the margin and just handing it to the customer and then telling them, hey, you're a sucker if you ever pay full price. And then I have no levers to pull in terms of, hey, what if you order two items? Hey, what if your order size reaches over this? Hey, what if you subscribe, or whatever the thing is, right? And so I think pulling back and figuring out how to sort of like increase like the perceived value of the product and really like lean on and leverage that is like really the thing. So when I'm walking like a business through sort of the first 4 weeks of working together with Proteus, is we go through and you tear down the business, I pretend I'm acquiring it. And I do basically like due diligence from that perspective and like what I would do with it. The way we kind of look at it then is I say like, okay, you know, your real expansion opportunity maybe is in this other ancillary product that you've just added, right? That you're trying to sort of like run again, like a business within the business. So can we leverage that as like a GWP over a certain threshold or in place of that initial offer or whatever, where I can specifically put product in the hands of the customers to sort of bolt on these other like buying modalities. For some of them, when we kind of break it down, it's like, hey, you have these three introductory things, right? So we have another customer that has a subscription product. You can buy like sample packs all the way up to like a big pack of something. And in kind of like playing around with the data, we found like actually the people that come in and just buy like a sample pack are deadbeat customers. Like they're pulling down your average like super hard, right? Like I can look at the histogram of this and I can look at what's AOV per product purchase or whatever the thing is. They don't come on to like do anything else. So also you have to think about the fact that when you're sending a signal back to Meta, you're telling them what happened in the order. They're not really looking at like lifetime margin, right? So it's optimizing for like that first order and you're optimizing for the lifetime of the customer. So how can we bring those things like into closer alignment? And so we'll look at things like, for that example, they maybe have five different flavors of this thing that you can try. So we bundle them all together into an everything pack where you can just try all the stuff. Now, we hemorrhaged a bunch of customers that were just going to come in and buy a 10 pack of one thing and then maybe they like it, maybe they don't, but they were all deadbeats anyway. Right. So we won the game on overall revenue produced for the customers. We won the game on lifetime value because those people had a better chance of finding a flavor that they liked and going out purchasing it like longer tail. And then we super won the game by telling Meta that this is who they should be optimizing for, not 100 people that all bought like a 10 pack or whatever the thing is. And so that's sort of what I mean by the sort of like the holistic thing and how we're kind of focusing on that for yes, profitability, but then also like the, again, like the aligning incentives. We have more levers to pull and we can, again, on the paid side of things, we can do the stuff we want to be doing.
You got me thinking when you were talking around like just, we'll call it like different levers a brand has. And I'm curious, do you have sort of a hierarchy of levers? And I mean that from everything from, you know, conversion rate to retention to cross-selling to introducing additional products. You know, I think one thing I've sort of, one thing I've noticed is certainly like, and we'll call it earlier, I won't call it early D2C, but like 4 or 5 years ago, you saw brands that only had one or two SKUs. And what was funny was Scott, founder of Sir Kensington's, was talking about, he was remarking, wow, what's amazing about D2C is that company, like back in his day, in like the OG D2C day, they like the way they grew their business wise was by introducing new products. And he was remarking that, wow, like these new brands don't need to do that. And then he and I were joking, I think about a month or so ago, and I was like, well, actually, I guess you're right. Like, you're looking at all these companies that only had one or two SKUs really struggling because they don't have ways to continue to sell to people or to like bundle. And so again, going back to, I'm curious that any of your analysis, like, is there sort of a way that you look at in terms of like, from a business perspective, like what is going to have the biggest impact? And I know that's a very broad, possibly like unhelpful question, but my guess is that you have a sense of just sort of how you're, again, quantifying as well as analyzing these businesses around like, what can they do to have an impact?
Yeah, totally. So there's sort of like different meaningful categories of businesses as it relates to this question. One of them is essentially like how elastic is like the demand at the consumer level, right? So I can drink five times as much coffee. I will not do five times as much laundry, right? I will not drive five times as many cars simultaneously. There's like all these things, right, that are sort of like limited in consumer behavior. Now there's like wiggle room within those things, but it kind of depends on the brand. So for some things, right, like consumable products that are very like that can expand quite a bit, right? You can, again, the coffee example or something like that. Offering other products within the same space or whatever can be a way to like increase like novelty, to be able to do bundles. You can get larger initial orders because you can focus on getting people to try multiple things. All of this stuff is like really, really good. And it gives us a good signal about how to optimize again for the best customers, because the thing that I'm really focused on is how do I figure out which customers are the good ones and just not give a shit about the ones that are bad, right? Mm-hmm. And if you don't have sort of these like mixture of like introductory ways of someone to engage with the brand, it's really hard to suss that out. And so that's why you get these like blended averages things. So I like a couple of things I like. Yeah, of course, conversion rate is always like a good idea, but sometimes I'll sacrifice conversion rate for AOV if I know I'm filtering for like a better customer that's going to help the brand like long-term. Expanding products is like the scariest thing that you can do as a brand, especially when you have few SKUs. The most terrifying moment always for me is navigating a brand through going from selling one SKU to two SKUs, because they just now added an additional choice that every single customer must make to successfully make a purchase. And that should be terrifying if you have ever looked at the math. So you want that Venn diagram to be very much in your favor. But the other thing too is like, post-purchase or upsells or things like that. So the things that I look for are, how can I incentivize good behavior in like that first order through like some sort of progressive discount, a GWP, whatever the thing is? Try not to give away money or margin for no effort, an unearned discount or something, because you just let all of the just deadbeats into the door. And then a post-purchase upsell that makes you go deeper in the ecosystem. So I'm really focused on like, how is this purchase modality like really getting me into the ecosystem of the product, right? So it might be like an accessory or something that validates the purchase like at that sort of stage, or makes it more useful or whatever, that I'm trying to form like a habit or get them to go deeper on it or something like that. So those are the levers that I'm really looking at in terms of like, overall, like how can like a business grow? And then of course you have the other example, which is getting into other categories. And I really think that when you get into other categories, you absolutely must treat it as if you are starting another business within the business and just basically using the branding of the first one. If you don't sort of think about it from that strategy, you end up cannibalizing the core almost every single time. And you don't actually achieve any growth. You just fracture your focus and increase the amount of work that you have to do to maintain the damn thing. So like if you sell whatever, if you sell shirts and you want to go to outerwear, like sure, try to get your shirt people to buy outerwear, but like focus on the fact that you have an outerwear business now and think about like the cross-pollination of those things is oftentimes much easier than like building a business around the core of whatever that additional product is. But I see lots of people screw this up where they build a product that nobody's really asking for, that doesn't actually fit with their key demographic. Like you might create a product, let's say your AOV or the single purchase is like $50 and you want to increase AOV. So you go make a product that costs $80. Well, you've not really validated this, right? Like you have to be able to make that $80 product like stand on its own two legs. You can't assume that you're going to take your $50 demographic and slide them up to like the 80. You might actually be going after two completely different audiences.
Got it. Okay. So what you're saying is essentially don't just create a me too product where the whole strategy is simply to cross sell people. It's really, this is a product that if your original hero product were to disappear, essentially you could build a business around this other product.
Mm-hmm. It comes into fungibility. So like one of my favorite things to do is we've done some legal price testing and then also testing of introducing new products. And one of the dumbest things that I hear people say is, hey, we released a new product. It's a hit. Like 20% of our revenue now comes from this product. Well, if it's fungible with the first like 20% and you just took it from the other product, now you're maintaining two damn products and you could have just done it with one, right? You didn't do anything. You actually just spun your wheels a little bit and increased your overhead. So I've even seen interesting things where, you know, a company has introduced a product. We've taken a look at what happens when we increase the price or we decrease the price and we sort of look at like units sold and like the overall units sold don't go up at all. AOV doesn't even go up at all. It's just you just have people, there's like a switching that goes on where people switch from one product to the other and your mixture changes. Now, that's a powerful lever because one of the things that I'm always thinking about, right, holistically for the business is what did you buy stock in? Because once you have it, it's sunk cost, right? And so we've actually done a lot of really fun things around how to move dead stock post-purchase or use it as like an incentive or something, right? Where you like, oh, you spend this many dollars, we give you a free t-shirt. It just so happens to be a t-shirt that we bought way too many of last year. But it's a way for us to sort of move it and then it's all cream or something like that. But that's the kind of stuff I think you got to think about in that regard.
I'm curious, what are some of the most impactful sort of strategies? Like, so, you know, I think there's been a shift, or certainly at least like what's in vogue right now is essentially, I'm trying to think of it, what fondue is, right? It's not cash back, or I guess it's cash back towards your next order as opposed to discounts, you know? So part of that's around like frustration with like discount codes being leaked and stuff like that. But I'm curious, what are the strategies that you're seeing and that you like, and like what are ones that you see people I would say adopting that, I'd say in practice, don't really work or haven't worked.
I have this amazing strategy for how to keep discount codes from getting leaked, which is that you don't use them. but the thing with the fondue thing or whatever, like, so what's the reason? There's all these.
I feel like I'm making. You're taking off your glasses, so I feel like something's happening over there.
Not the level in the discussion. We're going rogue here. So there's all these platforms that want to sell you on the pop up, the upsell, the fancy pants cart, the post purchase whatever, the cashback situation, and they will in their dumb little presentation hit you with all of this. These like slides that say we generate this much revenue, we increase this thing. And like, you can't believe any of it because they're not doing it against a control. Right. And so one of my least favorite things to do is we'll have a client that'll be like, hey, we want to do this fondue thing. A bunch of people said it's great on Twitter, which is a whole other thing. But, we go to test it, and the answer is that the customer actually doesn't really like it because you as a person don't like it. This is my first question. Hey, someone's like, what should we do for a pop-up? And I was like, how do you feel about pop-ups? And they're like, what do you mean? And I was like, when you go to buy stuff on the internet, like, how do you feel about them? They're like, oh, I hate them. And I'm like, why the fuck are we doing it? Right? For like, hey, if I told you that I give you a discount for spending a bunch of money or cash back, what do you want? Like, I want the discount. What if I give you cash back? Well, that kind of sucks. Yeah, you're right. So like when we actually test it against control, it kind of sucks. But when you just do it in pure isolation and they're like, look, people are using it. They've redeemed all this stuff and that's money you didn't have to give them as a discount. You're like, yeah, thanks. You hemorrhaged 5% of my transactions as like a result of doing this. But sure, I'm great. I'm so glad that like 10% more, whatever money is getting used as cash back or whatever the thing is. But they'll hit you with all these figures with like, nobody ever redeems it. I'm like, I know, because it sucks. This kind of stuff drives me absolutely batshit crazy because it is the opposite of doing a good job as a business, right? So your job as a business is to make a great product and then figure out how to like nurture the customer into going deeper into the ecosystem and just run a real, like a real business, right? And then trying to do all this like knee jerk, like I'm going to send you 50,000 text messages with like attentive and cover the entire screen with a pop-up. And then we're going to give you cash back instead of a discount because like we want, you're just digging yourself a hole. Like that's not like true optimization. It's not like true business growth. You end up just hamstringing yourself into the future. So that's my official stance on it.
Like, ladies and gentlemen, if you had any question of where Matthew falls on this topic.
Yeah, it's like website redesigns. Hey, we're going to do a website redesign. Why? Well, because we think the other one's getting stale. Okay, well, like you're not buying stuff on it. You're like your customers are and they never heard of you before. So like, I mean, I guess that's a way to spend like a colossal amount of money. The real answer is, hey, running a business is hard. You know what sounds like fun? Making a new website. So we're going to spend $250,000 on a bunch of artists, put something in their portfolio, and then we're going to average 10% of our transactions and go through 6 months of hell. And that's actually what a website redesign is in practice.
That's insane. You just got me thinking. One thing I'm curious about, is there anything that you, like in recent memory, believed the opposite of? And then from experience, like have basically completely changed your stance on?
Oh, I fucking love having my mind changed. So here's an interesting thing, right? I used to be like, no pop-ups, just get this shit out of here. Like I hate it. Like, and I was like, I can't find any modality in which it wins. Like we're just doing it wrong. Like just don't do it. Right. And I have joyfully had to eat shit on this a little bit because, there are certain customer demographics where it is incredibly effective if you can get the recipe right. And it's like to the degree that we have slam dunked it. So, to the right audience, a GWP gift with purchase pop-up incentive is incredible. And especially even like we've had clients where they have historically given away like a first order discount, like a lot. So they've conditioned all the users to take a discount. There's no way out of it. We're too far down the rabbit hole on it. Right. And, you know, in spite of my best efforts to try to remove that first order discount, like the math doesn't work out. Like it's better to have it. But the thing that I've had to learn, right? Because I want to be correct. I don't want to be right. Right. So in testing lots of things, what we basically found is if you can get the right gift with purchase type thing, like on a pop-up or something like that, a pop-up can be incredibly powerful. If you can time it right to the right users with the right offer, you can actually attract like really high value customers. And it's a good signal that they're actually going to go on to actually have like a good lifetime value because they're interested in going deeper in the ecosystem out of the gate.
And what are some of the ingredients of that?
Yeah. So I've developed a more like maturated strategy around this as I've just decided to embrace what works. And one of my favorite things is oftentimes we will have like some key value prop or whatever that gets buried like along the journey or doesn't get revealed until the end. So it might be like a guarantee, like, hey, if you don't like this, whatever, we'll give you the money back. Or hey, we're throwing this extra thing like in your order or whatever, that's going to, whatever the thing is. And you don't find out about it till later, but it's like kind of too late. They already made the damn decision to purchase by the time they got there. So one of my favorite recipes is pulling forward into like that initial pop-up, whatever that thing is, and tying it to giving the email. It's a painted door that you're going to get it either way. But I've actually just pulled a key value prop up to the front, made sure that you see it, and then let you signal to me that you're a good customer by giving me the email address like at the right time. But everybody ends up getting it in the end anyway. That is an incredibly effective strategy. And I'm like exploring all the different possible permutations of that right now with lots of our clients, especially headed into Q4.
Interesting. And just so that I'm clear on what you mean, like, so in that case, I'm on a value proposition, but I think what you were saying is like, well, I guess, okay, in this case, you were saying like, essentially it's a pop-up that's effective at collecting someone's contact information. It's not about giving them a free product necessarily. It's about getting them to sign up for something. And maybe that's with a gift with purchase, but it sounds like you're really saying more like, yeah. Do you like an example?
Yeah. So like an interesting example might be, okay, like oftentimes brands will throw like something else in an order, right? Some other accessory type product that they have that's like incredibly low COGS or whatever that they try to like bleed over, right? Into another category. So, and it may be a thing that bolts onto the product. So like if it was like shoes, it might be socks, or if it was, if it's like a food product thing, it might be some other like ancillary thing that they offer. Sometimes it's even less than that. It's like a, hey, you're going to try this new supplement or whatever the thing is. And if you don't like feel amazing in like 30 days or whatever, we're just going to refund you. Right. And so you can increase the perceived value of whatever that thing is by gating it. So, and you can make sure that nobody misses it. So I can say, hey, give us your email and then we will give you this like 30, this like bold 30-day guarantee or whatever, where we'll give you the money back. People are like, oh shit, give you the email address. They go on to make the purchase. The guarantee is for everybody, but they feel like they earned it, right?
Got
so
it.
There's a sort of gamification aspect to it, and they definitely didn't miss it, right? Because none of that stuff gets buried. You know, a 30-day money back guarantee, what, everybody's got this, whatever. But ours, you only get if you give me the email address, right? Mm-hmm. So, that sort of like emphasis there kind of like heightens the thing that already exists. You change nothing about your infrastructure of like how you're running the business or anything, right? You're just fiddling around a little bit with the value props and the levers that you have to pull and making sure that people don't miss them and that kind of stuff. So that, it's like, without getting too specific into certain clients or whatever, that's like my best example I can give off the cuff.
No, that's helpful. Thanks. And in terms of even strategies, because you mentioned, I mean, you alluded to the fact that we're coming into Black Friday, Cyber Monday. You've already said that you detest coupons. So what strategies do you sort of employ around now? And like, to what extent do you treat like this time of the year as a different period for a brand than like the other, the other days?
The other days. Yeah. So the question always is like, what is Q4 for? Like, what are we doing for? Right. Like, and it depends on the business. If it's kind of like a one and done business where we get the customer, that's the sale and I'm never going to see him again. Right. Because there's just no like longevity to the thing. That's a different strategy than we're trying to acquire customers for our subscription based product that we want to hang on to later. Right. And so when I think about Q4, I get really laser focused on, you got to give them something. Like this is like the special time, right? Whether that's, I love a low COGS gift that everybody gets when they place their order during a certain period of time. It doesn't devalue the core product. You make a shit ton more money. It doesn't dirty the bathtub with a bunch of like deadbeat people that are all coming on like high discount fever or whatever, which is the thing we see, right? Like you move a tremendous amount of inventory or something at like basically no margin. The customers are all crap for lifetime value. And then you got to go place a new order in Q1. You didn't use up all the cash you made in Q4. You would have been better to just sit on it, right? That's like the classic failure of a Q4 situation. So I like getting very, very heavy into a progressive unlock, right? And so doing tiered discounts and like trying to communicate that to customers before they like get fully in doesn't really work. The way that we try to do it is oftentimes we'll build like a custom module in the cart. We'll talk about it, or we're like, hey, spend more money. You're going to save. You're going to get all these free gifts, right? Now you get a t-shirt. Now you get 20% off, whatever the thing is. And they kind of watch that slide and unlock as they're adding stuff to the cart, because you also have to think about like, how do you use carts? Like, how do you use carts, right? You open up like a bajillion tabs of stuff. You just throw a bunch of shit into the cart to keep track of it or whatever. And then you go out and you call the herd of stuff that you aren't serious about purchasing. But if you've like come all the way up to unlocking all of these discounts and like free gifts and all of this stuff or whatever, you're going to leave more shit in the cart if that's what it took to sort of unlock the things. So that's really what I'm focused on for Q4 is how can I find people that need an incentive, like a greater incentive when they kind of expect it, and just encourage them to go as deep as possible, knowing that I want to like hang on to them like later as like a good customer or something like that. You want to avoid doing, again, like a completely under-earned thing where maybe they didn't need 40% off of literally everything in the damn store to place the order, and you just like bumpkin yourself at a 20% gross or 40% of the margin for no reason. Because that's the thing, is like, I want to only apply the discount to the people that needed it and were going to take it, because otherwise you're just like doing this ham-fisted strategy where you just blanket discount everything. People that didn't need that much of a discount to be incentivized, you lost all of that, like that revenue that you could have captured. So getting more smart about it, acknowledging the fact that it's Q4, like people are going to come for discounts and special deals that they're never going to get. I love it when we can do like a limited edition product, or we can do like a gift with purchase or something that makes it feel really, really special and not go so heavy on the discounts. But then for people, if you want to come buy five things, like, hell yeah, I'm going to give you a discount. It's fine.
Got it.
I love that our podcast turned into Ben pokes the bear and then I rant.
And then I recover. Well, part of it is I'm trying to like go off of specific things you said, as opposed to just asking you all of the questions that have been holed up in my brain since the last time we spoke.
Yeah.
Because one thing I kept thinking about was, I don't know if you'd read Patrick Campbell's post from Profitwell. I think they published it a couple of years ago, maybe it's been 3 years ago around. It was basically questioning if subscription fatigue's a thing. And as I recall, he broke it down by category.
Yeah.
Digital products versus CPG products. And within CPG, you have, depending on what the reason is of someone subscribing, is it a replenishment product? Is it a curation product? Is it, and I'm curious if you've observed any changes in like user or consumer behavior over the last, call it like 18 months or so, because I think Patrick's gist was, and do you know what I'm referring to? I don't know if you happen to come across it.
I don't. Sometimes okay. I on purpose keep myself siloed away from the what's the hotness. But yeah. It's already a thoughtful answer because it depends by the by category first, right?
Yeah, and they were specifically looking at, because Profitwell has all this data, right, of all of these consumer as well as B2B businesses around essentially like. They're like, it's an enormous sample size. And his gist was, I mean, part of it was like elasticity, right? So part of what's happening, at least with digital subscriptions, is you're having this bundling and unbundling. And yeah, like, you know, there's only so many subscriptions you're going to have, and people are kind of getting tired of subscribing. He saw, as I recall, less burnout when it came to products that you need, right? Which makes sense, right? It's like, I need this for my household. So it's not going to really impact whether or not I'm going to continue subscribing. Although I think with that said, I know the average is around like two or three for people who do subscribe to something, the upper ceiling is like 2 to 3 products, which makes sense because the average order value is so much higher for CPG products versus digital products, right? Like you can have Amazon well, I guess you get it with Prime. So maybe like you can have Netflix, you can have Hulu, you can have Max. Like literally, if I go through the list of like entertainment subscriptions that I have, I'm like,
I
there's apps I use now just to figure out which show or TV or movie is free on one channel because it's often free not on another one, right? Like we are at peak for me. But I keep finding I have to reactivate old subscriptions that I canceled because I'm like, crap, all right, that's on PBS.
Right, and it's the worst too, because it's like for some of the digital goods, it's like, I will just pay $4 to watch the thing right now. Like I don't even care what the subscription is, right? Because it is. It's like, how many times have I reactivated and then deactivated my Netflix subscription? Way too many. Is anytime I was like really wanted to watch like a show or something like that, right? And it's like, is there another modality possible there where I just buy the damn season like it's a DVD and be done with it, right? So the buy category answer is totally correct. We're seeing like a similar thing, which is, you know, do I need to buy toilet paper like individually every single time I need it? No, actually, it kind of sucks because you know that you need it when you need it, right? And so, so I think the trend that I have seen is COVID did a wonderful job of everybody getting into subscriptions, because also that was like kind of the only way you could guarantee you were going to get some products. Mm-hmm. Right. And then it made it acceptable. Right. So like subscription, especially for more like conservative people financially, it was like morally repugnant, but like now it's fine. I think it's like the big unlock. So for certain consumer goods and things like that, it's just made it an okay buying modality. And there's certain things where it makes sense for, right? Like toilet paper, wipes for things, like detergent, like whatever, like you should just be subscribed to that. Like it's stupid not to, because you're just going to use all this brain space buying the same damn thing over and over again. So there's that component to it. For other products, yeah, like we've seen like a decent amount of pullback, like on some of it where it's like, well, I don't know how fast I go through it. And like, it's kind of annoying when I have too much of like the thing or whatever. Right. And so then it's like, can you do a good job as a brand of kind of like meeting the customer and making it easy for them to buy in bulk or something like that. Right. Like a consumable product, especially something that doesn't have like a, something that doesn't have a short shelf life. Like, like we found like for consumable products and things like that, if it has a long shelf life, people just buy it in bulk. And then like when it kind of starts getting low, they'll just buy more of it, right? And that's actually a fine modality. They don't need to be on a subscription. Now, for things that have like a, are more fragile, right? That like expire, like food and beverage things or whatever that maybe like expire, subscription still seems pretty durable, like on those things, because there is this window. Like if I end up with too much coffee, like beans, even like in my cupboard, like they go bad before I can like consume them. Right. So, but like on the flip side, like if I run out, like it takes forever to get it and things like that. So I'm surfing this thing, like a subscription just makes sense. I can't bulk buy coffee. It'll just go bad. Right. Nor do I want to try to remember. I just want the damn thing to show up to my house. But like, there's like a liquid supplement thing that I use for, hydration and, energy and things like this. But, it's like shelf stable for like a year. Like I'll just buy like a shit ton, like put some of it in the basement. And then when I'm like, oh, it's like kind of like the last like three boxes, just go bulk buy more of it. And that's fine. So I think it's like, I hate Twitter and people like talking about e-commerce on it. So I just never look at it because it's all this like super ham-fisted, like overgeneralization of everything. And then people talking about like, oh yeah, we increased our like subscription percentage. Like if I hear one more person also talk about Athletic Greens, I'm probably going to puke. And here's the thing. Yeah. I heard so much about Athletic Greens. I finally just started drinking Athletic Greens just to see what the fuck is going on with this thing. Right. Here's the thing. How did I find out about Athletic Greens and decide to purchase it? It wasn't the website. People are like, we should make our website like Athletic Greens because Athletic Greens nailed subscription. I'm like, Athletic Greens nailed subscription on Instagram. Their website is like a means to an end. Like you've already decided to purchase by the time that you're there and they know it. There's nothing on that damn website. You shouldn't mimic it at all unless you're going to go spend $1 billion on influencers all telling you to drink this stuff or you're going to die.
Oh my God. That's awesome. And so what did you think of the product?
Yeah, it's probably fine. It's a guilt edge thing, right? Like I already eat lots of vegetables, but I'm like, manganese, like I don't know if I'm eating
them. Oh my God.
Well, so it's like for the low price of whatever the hell this thing costs, I can just never think about whether I'm getting adequate nutrition. So it's going to be fine is the short answer.
I like that. It's a hedge.
Exactly.
And I'm curious, so what have you seen firsthand? Like, are a lot of your brands around membership, like are a lot of the brands you work with, have they incorporated paid membership or doing free membership and or subscription? And like, how has that kind of come into your own sort of strategy?
Oh, so like membership and then also like the subscription.
Component.
Uh-huh. So I think the thing is, right, like I usually say, like the goal for subscription is to make you feel stupid for buying one time. Like that's basically it. Like, right. But then if you're going to commit to one time, I want to let you like claw back like as much as possible. So like I have successfully talked most businesses off the ledge of just focus on subscription. Now there's an asterisk there, which is there are some businesses where I'm like, subscription is the only part of your business that actually exists. One time is a means to getting people to subscribe later that won't do it today. And that's absolutely the way you should think about it. For things that are like sort of set it and forget it, like you need them on a subscription, otherwise the lifetime value just doesn't pan out, right? Like, and, that, mm-hmm. and that's just the answer. But you know, thinking about it more like holistically and like the strategy is, I want to de-emphasize one time, right? If I can highlight all the benefits of subscription, get you to go deeper into like a bundle and reward you for doing so. But if you decide to go off onto one time land, I want to give you the opportunity to save as much, almost as much or as much as if you were to subscribe by showing me that you're a good user, right? So it might be a bulk buying opportunity in a case where the product doesn't expire or something. So I think it is the best of both worlds. And what I'm sort of counseling brands on right now is, especially specifically around subscription, is give your one-time customers the chance to prove themselves and earn the same discount as subscription by going deep into the ecosystem.
Got it. So in this case, and is this, I guess what I didn't hear you say was anything around like that to me also speaks to like, in some ways, this loyalty rewards, right? Or a progressive discount based off of how often you're buying it. What I didn't hear you say was like paid membership, right? So let's say
I think the paid membership thing is a total fucking racket.
Why like is that?
have a good product or don't. Like, I don't know. Like, a lot of these public goods. This is like a funny example, mm-hmm. right? They're like, ooh, subscribe to our thing. And then if you subscribe to it, then you can buy from us. And I'm like, what kind of like gated fourth, like level of hell is this? Like, I have to pay money to like shop at your shop. Like, get the fuck out of here with that. Right. And then they did this thing where like, clearly that wasn't working. So they just sent mm-hmm. this like email to everybody where they're like, oh, just give us $20 right now and you can be a member forever. Which was like hilariously pathetic. And then they've gone to like the third level of desperation where they're like, actually, we're getting rid of the membership thing altogether. Well, no shit, right? It's an outdated modality. I don't think it makes any damn sense.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I think I saw that, and I saw another site network do that. I think, you know, what I've been seeing certainly pop up within the Shopify space is paid memberships where in exchange for the membership, when that membership might be annual, it might be lifetime, is getting we'll call it basically a subscription discount. On top of all of your subsequent purchases, as well as maybe like a free gift or something like that.
The thing is that if you think about like the alignment of incentives and like how much thought, care, and focus that a customer is going to give to this transaction, you're adding an awful lot of complexity. Like I would challenge whether or not you could just do better by aligning the incentives more linearly with you spend more money and we give you better deals and arrangements, right? So it's like it seems like it is an attempt again to like weed out good one-time customers versus not one-time customers or subscription or whatever the thing is. But again, I think it's like a pretty ham-fisted way of doing it. I think there are better modalities to suss out the same answer without adding all this complication and this additional decision that must be made on top of whether or not the product is good enough.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, I think my understanding of the strategy there is finding other ways to increase contribution margin, which again, we'll call it like all things being equal, yes, makes sense from a business perspective. And then incentivizing someone once they've sort of made that initial commitment that they're more likely to continue buying in order to maximize the utility of that paid subscription and front loading as much value, saying this, you're paying $100 for this and you're getting $200 worth of, we'll call it value.
Yeah, it seems like a compromise for just actually having a good product.
Mm. Awesome. No, I mean, like, this is why I'm asking, is because A, I'm curious from, you know, talking to you who look at this from the obviously very analytical and math perspective and haven't been doing this for a long time, the NASA plus SWAT team approach. I think, you know, what's always interesting with all this stuff is just not just questioning whether or not we should be doing it, but really thinking through what's the goal and like, mm-hmm. why are we doing it? And then like the why behind the why. And then I guess that's the circular question of why five times. And you know, and I, you know, there's very valid reasons for like a lot of strategies, but it's important to at least think it through and talk through what people are seeing. Mm-hmm. Anything that I haven't brought up that you're just dying to talk about? Are there things that you need to get off your chest because I haven't helped you unload it yet? Or
don't worry, I've done a decent job thus far just weaving literally anything I wanted to talk about into your questions, whether you're directly asking it or not. No, I think the other really interesting thing. So I'll talk about. Here's what I want to talk about. Today was the day that Google Optimize finally shut everybody's shit off.
Oh wow.
So they like when that date first came out and they were like September 30th, I was like, that is a Saturday. You're full of it. Right. And they were in fact, but today, right. Like, today was the day. And so, it's very interesting because most people that are doing testing, you know, whether it's Google Optimize or otherwise are doing it completely wrong. Like they have no idea what they're doing. They're committing all sorts of statistical fallacies and things like that. My favorite thing is doing an audit and being like, I'm really sorry, but you can't use any of the results from previous tests. We're going to have to run them all again because you didn't pre-calculate minimum sample size and you committed the peaking problem and the multiple comparisons problem, et cetera, et cetera. I'll save you the diatribe on that. But as we're kind of like looking at like the macro of that space and like really trying to like dial into how you meaningfully grow a business, like, the answer is that you're gonna like everybody is different. Like there's no sort of widespread like way to sort of like optimize. And so the thing that I'm really excited about right now that we're doing at Proteus is trying to unearth specific interactions or purchase behavior or product behavior or things like that that lead to the things that we're trying to achieve. And actually optimize like around those things. So you may like deploy a test globally, but I would say like, I like trying to make this as clear as possible. So I'll talk about numerator, denominator all the time. Numerator is the thing we're looking for. Denominator, the people, right, that are valid for it. So I may deploy a test globally, but my numerator might not even be purchases. It might be if I sell like wipes with the dispensers or something, it might be dispensers, my dispensers sold. That's the numerator of my fraction. My denominator is added to cart. I only want to see the people that have already added to cart or whatever the thing is, right? To show some level of intent. And you can start to fill around with this and like really, really drive into figuring out how to optimize for very specific behaviors that go much beyond like the surface level of conversion rate or even like revenue per customer, whatever the thing is, that you really dive into that, like that lifetime value conversation. And I think that actually the sunset of Google Optimize is a great thing to happen for conversion optimization, because a lot of this like kind of bullshit stuff where people come in and they're like, we're going to change the homepage hero headline. Like, is there a time and a place for that? Yes. Can you run 5 variations of that on a site that has like 1,000 transactions a month? Hell no. You're never going to achieve significance, honestly, but people can't do math. So whatever. So it's exciting for me because it is pushing everyone to do sort of better. Probably, you know, the optimist in me is like, and people are going to be smarter about this. And the real answer is just going to go jump off to some other platform and park around and find out. But it is exciting. And I think it's a good opportunity to talk more more about like what is the value of some of these platforms and like what are we trying to achieve through optimization, and can we have a more complex discussion than some of these just like incredibly surface level metrics and tests.
So I'm curious, what tools are you advising people to use, or are you using yourself, if since website or Google Optimize, website optimized, Google Optimizes Sunset?
Well, so the thing with Google Optimize, right, is like, what is it? Like, what is a conversion rate, like optimization platform really doing, right? Because like you really got to think about this. And the answer is, it's deploying some JavaScript that contains usually like HTML, JavaScript, or CSS, and injecting it into the head to affect the client side of like a site. That's trivial to do. Like you could do it with Google Tag Manager, right? Mm-hmm. So then it's like, well, but then like, what is it doing? Well, it's doing it for a random percentage, whatever you set, of users, and then tagging those users. So when they come back, they see it again, right? That's actually not horrifically. Now there's lots of like super technical things that like get in the way and like you've got to do all this. But from like a very surface level, that's not very complicated. It's administering a JavaScript file to a certain percentage of users and tagging them for analytical purposes, right? So we're actually like deploying our own tests like through our own means. And that changes from customer to customer, right? Like some clients are on a headless site, just in spite of my, you know, encouragement not to do this. Some clients have these complicated setups with like Google Analytics, in spite of the vanilla one being kind of the right answer usually, et cetera. So we're just kind of tailoring our deployment strategy to the client in particular. Now it's all running on Shopify, so it has some like homogeneity to it, but you know, all the tools are basically the same. It's usually the person running the tool that's the damn problem on the administration side of things, because they all just deploy in a damn JavaScript file at the end of the day. So if you need a WYSIWYG editor, go find something that has a WYSIWYG editor. If you have a team like us that can just do the damn thing, then just prepare the thing and deploy it. The really interesting thing is when we get onto the reporting side of things, right? Because Google Optimize was like, again, like pretty ham-fisted anyway. You pick a couple of metrics and then you just look at a chart with some like bars and stuff that do like this. And then you go, I watched it every single day. And then the day I like the result, I pick the winner. And like, and everybody does that no matter what the platform is. And that's one of the fallacies that people screw up with this stuff. So really, like, it's hard to go into Google Analytics or any of these other platforms really and like get the answer that you want out and be able to filter the data down. And so we've rolled our own software that interacts with the GA4 API so that we can do all these analysis. So we're calculating relative change for numerator, denominator, p-values, the whole nine yards. And then I like teaching the client how to interpret it, because I don't want it to be magic, because that's dumb, because then they can't see how awesome we are. But I mean, in terms of tools, yeah, they all do about the same shit. It's really the person running the tool that ends up being the success or not, because you can deploy tests, you can read the results off the paper of whatever it says, but unless you really understand statistically what's going on, yeah, you're probably going to screw it up. So, the short answer is that we've done our own custom thing for this because it serves our clients better. And at that level of scale, like, we have some really, really fine-grained KPIs usually that we're kind of optimizing for. And so it allows us to tailor the entire ecosystem really holistically around their business and like help them pull the levers we're trying to pull together, and then, you know, educate them on how to read the reports. So how's that for a non-answer answer and a plug for the stuff that we're doing that's super cool?
That's a very good answer. Not one I expected. Do you have a name for it?
Huh. Here's a funny thing. You've also
Proteus Optimized.
Yeah, exactly. So early on when we talked about it, this like 6 months ago at Proteus, when we were talking about taking some of the things that we're already doing and kind of productizing them, someone's like, what are we going to call it? And I was like, no names. And they're like, what? And I was like, we don't name it. And they're like, why? And I was like, every band you started in high school has the same problem. You all sit around figuring out a cool name for the band, and then you never play any music. I refuse to name this. So it's been sitting under the code name band name, literally forever, with Proteus. It now works, and we're using it on clients and things as part of like the transition off of Google Optimize or whatever. So we are now in the phase where I'm going to throw a party internally for the Proteus folks, and then we're going to name it. But it has to work. I was like, names are for things that work. Once it works and it makes money, then you're allowed to name it. So we'll be having our naming party here. I've got to get it on the calendar, but
so it's like you can name your band once you've released your first album.
That's basically it. You're over the album and you decide what your damn band name is. Yeah.
And you've gotten it into Virgin Records.
Exactly. And exactly.
You're,
well, look, I'm doing sophisticated analysis right now, like with our clients, and using the tool, and it's still under code name, band name.
It's like they probably think you're in GarageBand. They're like, wow, I didn't know you could use GarageBand for this.
Right, right. It's literally that.
Awesome, yeah. Man. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. If I'm curious, do you, you're obviously not on Twitter. Are you writing about any of this stuff or sharing your very strong opinions anywhere?
Yeah, in spite of my best efforts, I've been encouraged to write a bit more about these things. So I like the podcast format a whole lot. So as much as you'll come on and whinge about it, I think that is lovely. And then I'll have to start kind of posting them in aggregate on LinkedIn, that sort of thing. No, but I'm in the process actually of writing up a few things for a newsletter, actually, for some. I love this format. I come and I talk, and then you do all the work. Like, this is great for me. Yeah.
Or I sit there trying to process what you just said, and I'm following along, and I'm like, okay, this is the challenge of trying to go with and we'll call it like listening to what someone's saying, and then coming up with the questions based off of the conversation slowing.
Yeah, no, Eric, you're lovely. No, you can find me on the old-fashioned LinkedIn if people still use that sort of thing. And well, since they know you, that's a great way to get a hold of me.
Okay, that's perfect. And someday maybe you'll have your paid membership Substack where you'll employ all of your. I think if we know you, there would be no discount code. It might not be. It wouldn't. Well, I'm trying to think. Would your Substack technically be paid? Because your whole point would be, it has to be good enough for someone to continue to pay for it to be consumed. So yes, you would not be, you definitely would want and be open to charging for your Substack. What you wouldn't do is give a discount for annual subscribers. If they want to get your goods, they'll pay full price monthly.
That's right.
Or monthly times 12 for an annual.
What if you do annual, I'll give you a free hat.
There you go. Like, there you go. And it'll just say band name.
Just his band name. Proteus logo, just band name under it.
Like the college shirt, just college. Band.
Band.
Well, awesome, man. Thanks so much for coming on. And we'll put links to all of your stuff in the show notes.
Sounds great, man. Always a pleasure.